Thinking about it right.
Going to open the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities.
Washington, D.C., bounded. Story.
It works pretty well. So I'm going to rearrange the agenda just a little bit. First, we're going to abolish the friars. Then we're going to talk about noxious weeds. Then, assuming I have the votes to abolish the friars, they want to be abolished. Then we'll do 2999, then 2214. So I'm going to open a public hearing and work session. This is carried over from the 319 agenda on House Bill 2630. And call Mike Dewey, Jeff Bradley, and Lorna Walker up.
2630.
Okay.
Did I open the public hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Friar Commission. You had a discussion a couple weeks ago about the Oregon Potato Commission. Unfortunately, a little bit of a different discussion in the sense that the Friar Commission, which was established in ORS 576, has made a decision and has gone through a very rigorous process to decide whether or not the commission is relevant in 2008, 2009, and going forward. We'd had provided a brochure for you just to get a sense of the mass of the industry in Oregon. Mr. Bradley is the chair of the commission, and he will discuss some of the decisions that were made for us to be before you today to discuss the abolishment of the Friar Commission. Last year, the Friar Commission adopted a temporary rule that suspended the assessment. And in January of this year, the Friar Commission adopted a permanent rule to suspend the assessment. And it was suspended on a few grounds. One is that the cost of doing business in the area of feed, the area of propane, other inputs had been extraordinary. And this was an opportunity for an industry that is in trouble today. Not only are the producers, but the processors, an opportunity to save some money in the process. Mr. Bradley will talk about what has changed since the development of the commission. He is a producer, and he can speak succinctly to that. Some of you will be disappointed that we're not going to be having a barbecue since this commission is, we think, going to be going away. It's actually going away, quite frankly, no matter what you do. But we do want to talk about the remaining balance. And I suspect if it wasn't in the neighborhood of $19,000, and that's what the balance will be as the commission closes down, it's estimated to be in that range, that the Oregon legislature probably would have absconded with that money also. But nonetheless, you have an amendment, and the amendment is on a pro rata basis to provide what is left, the $19,000, to the members that paid into the commission over a one-year period from September 1 of last year through August 31st. So that's basically why we're here today. This is something that we enjoy doing, but unfortunately, times have changed, and what we're going to do is have Mr. Bradley talk about what has changed here today, and then we'll, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, answer any questions.
Good morning. I'm Jeff Bradley. I have a poultry farm in Beaver Creek, Oregon. Grew up on it as a kid. My father and family has been in it for about 40 years. Commission's been around for just a little over 50. So what has changed? The industry was formed by the growers as the need they had to promote their product and the uniqueness of an Oregon product. And that's been the focus for many years. And things have changed over the years. Not alone financially in the way we make money and need things, But the way the processors that we raise for used to be half a dozen of them in the Oregon, Washington area. Now they're down to two. So the things that the commission was established for to promote our product, we don't need to advertise. They do the bulk of the advertising to sell the product. Years ago, they couldn't afford to. So we're not needing to do certain things like we used to. So the things we do as a commission are very good, and our dollars well spent. But as a processor or producer of chickens, I'm having a hard time making ends meet, and it's becoming very difficult to support something. Although I've been a chairman for almost 10 years and the commission for practically 15 myself, I hate to see it go. But what we do as a commission has changed dramatically of the need compared to when it was started. The growers formed it for a very good purpose, and the growers are in favor of this abolishment also. I don't know if I hit all those great questions, if there's any questions.
Questions for these two. Representative Krieger. It's been several days since I've seen you. I almost forgot who you were for a moment. I'm sorry.
I'll do something to remind you.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. No doubt.
Mr. Dewey, are you telling me that if we vote yes, we're not going to have a barbecue?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, no matter what you do, there's not going to be a barbecue.
Just a couple. How many members are there of the Fire Commission as far as growers that belong to it?
I believe it's in the mid-30 range of growers in Oregon.
Okay. Then they're still going to be producing birds. Are they still going to be marked as like an Oregon bird, so we know?
The marketing side is done by the processor, which the bulk of the Oregon birds are raised by Foster Farms under that label.
And yeah, they make quite a racket of the fact they're Oregon grown. I think it's great.
Well, I always look for, Mr. Chair, I always look for the birds. I think they're a better bird and they're fresher, so that's what I want. You know,
we don't have control of how they market them. Although the growers are still going to be there, we're still going to be raising chickens. That's not changing at all.
If I may, Mr. Chair, there's two processors, Draper and Foster, and Foster has the bulk of the farms, and it's a very interesting process in the sense that the Foster has some of their own farms that they own, and then you have independent entities like Mr. Bradley, who has all the infrastructure to grow the chickens. He doesn't own the chickens. The chickens are provided to him, and then he grows them to a certain size, and then they're taken. At that point in time, what we've seen is if you watch TV or listen to the radio, I'm not sure about the internet side of advertising for Foster, but they're doing all the advertising. So it was one of those situations that it got to, you don't need to advertise, and that's what you're about on the consumption side of chicken. So we're doing that. We want to sell our brand. It's a Northwest brand. Chickens are growing here. So it's one of those situations where at the end of the day, you had to look at your mission, and the mission had changed.
Is Foster headquartered in Washington?
California.
Or Oregon?
It's in California.
I believe their main headquarters in California, their processing facilities in Washington. Oregon is still very strong. They've never cut back in Oregon. We've actually been a growth area. It's a logistics and distance, and that's what's changed in the industry, too.
And what about Draper?
Draper's more in northern Washington. Yeah. They've scaled back slightly in Oregon just because of the distance and location.
That's interesting. Representative Van Orman.
Well, I still go back to the Belosiers on Beaver Creek. So
we used to raise for them.
Thank you. So the processor, so what you're doing now is basically selling it to this firm in Washington that does the processing? Do we have any? Let me ask the question. Are there any processors left in Oregon?
Currently, no.
Thank you.
Of any magnitude.
Of any magnitude.
Representative Wingard.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it's not really a question. I just wanted to let you know that it took me an hour to calm Representative Gilliam down and assure him that the roasts on Comedy Central would continue if if we move forward with this bill. He was very, very concerned about that.
I appreciate that. I wanted to get a unanimous vote, and he was grumbling all last week about this bill. So. Okay, we have one more witness, if anybody else. Okay, please.
Yes, Lorna Walker. And I'm here basically to raise some questions. Regrettably, I was not able to be present at your hearing last week, and I apologize for that.
Didn't end up holding it. We had to push it over till today. So you didn't.
All right. Well, then that clarifies that. So I really didn't miss anything then. And due to some personal circumstances, I haven't been able to do some research that I ordinarily would. My understanding is that, from what these gentlemen have said, that the growers don't really have very much to do with the processing. Yet I would have to feel that they would certainly have some impact on what happens in the processing. And over 10 years in Oregon, I have been impressed with simultaneously the absolutely fantastic, excellent quality of fryer chicken that has been put on the market and the availability of it. And at times where there were serious problems that, in my opinion, would affect public health, that stem back to what I would believe to be the processing area. And it has seemed to me that there has been some improvement in that in recent times, and yet last week I still got a package of chicken that contained within it, it was contained within it some chicken that had not been processed in a timely handling manner, and a good portion of it had to be thrown away. Customarily, I would take it back to the market and have a communication go back to the processor. But this is something that I think that the commission should have some influence upon. It's certainly not for me to say whether the commission should continue or not continue. I know that there's always a very delicate balance in the poultry industry between transportation, food, and the actual costs involved, both to the growers and the processors. I think it, if you look back at some of the events that have taken place over the last few years in health issues within the state, whether it was for turkey or whether it was for chicken or whatever, that much of that goes back to issues of processing where maybe they killed too many chickens at one time and didn't get them processed efficiently. When they start decomposing before they get to the freezer, you don't have a good product on the market. So basically what I want to say is I would like you to examine if the commission does not continue, what influence is going to be there to both protect the growers and the consumers. Thank you very much.
If we wanted to, we could probably have the Department of Ag up, but I'm fairly certain the answer is the commission has no role in regulatory authority on food safety. That would be the probably U.S. Department of Agriculture's meat inspection program, and that's in Oregon and Washington. It'll be the same exact process as now. They just won't have the kind of marketing function is what this commission does, and so Foster Farms and Draper will continue their commercials rather than just sort of generic Oregon commercials.
You understand that, and I understand that, but I also recognize that the grower and the commission do have influence, and that everyone has to work together on it.
Let's just check. Do you feel you have any kind of influence in what happens in the processing of the chickens once they leave the farm?
I have no control of how they
manage their end of the system. The processors are involved in the commission. They carry a seat on the commission, each of them. They've worked with the commission in our business, but we don't do anything or towards their sales and marketing and her difficulties with what comes out of the store.
Does the commission ever even talk or vote on things like that, food safety?
Only if it pertains to the growing of the birds on the farms and how we handle the live animals. All the rest is done by the processors.
And so if the commission goes away, then the companies that provide you chickens to grow, what rules they have around on-farm conditions?
Excuse me, I didn't quite understand that.
So if the Fryer Commission has discussions sometimes about on-farm conditions and it goes away, then the companies who provide you the chickens, they would be the ones saying, hey, we want to make sure that the chickens are, you know, grown under these conditions or something as a condition, of, or else you don't get their chickens, is my guess.
Correct. We have guidelines that they require us to follow in all of the raising and everything we do on the farm end.
If I may, Mr. Chair, a couple points. It's fairly technical and, if you will, high-tech in terms of the feeding pattern, the heating, cooling systems, and the like to protect the birds. I would say that a grower has a very significant interest in what the processor does, because if there are some issues, they're impacted by it in the sense that the consumption may go down, therefore their income goes down. So they do have a concern about what occurs. With regard to the testimony to my left, we don't know who this processor was. It could be, you know, we have a lot of Arkansas chickens that are brought into this market because that's a huge area of growing. But if the processors were here, they would say, we're very concerned and we do everything we can to make sure that this is something that is safe and sound.
And regulated by government.
There's no question about that. So that occurs all the time.
That will continue.
With or without the
process. Notwithstanding.
Okay, any questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
That's it?
Are we in work session?
Not yet. Anybody have any issues with this? Is this
ready for a motion, Mr. Chair?
Let me open the work session. Open a work session on House Bill 2630. I'm ready for that.
Mr. Chair, do we specifically talk about the Dash 1s?
We have not. So if we get a motion on them, then we can discuss them.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2630.
Representative Krieger moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments, dated March 17, 2009. Discussion. These are... Cheyenne, if you want to maybe fill us in again on Mr. Dewey referred to them, but
yes, Mr. Dewey, thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. The Dash 1 amendments clarify the payout to producers.
Okay. So they provide for the prorated last one year to each individual who paid in. Okay. Any discussion on those amendments?
Assessment.
Seeing none, is there objection to the amendments? Not, the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2630 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation at the subsequent referral as amended and the subsequent referral to revenue be rescinded.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2630 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue be rescinded. Is there discussion? Is there discussion?
I don't see why.
Good. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Roblin.
Aye.
Representative Joplin.
Aye.
Representative Wigan.
Aye.
Since it just replaced the seven.
Vice Chair Van Orden.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. The bill is sent to a floor as amended.
Can this be a consent calendar?
Any objection to the consent calendar?
No.
So ordered. one down, and Representative Gilliam didn't get to speak.
We did have a concern because it was assessments, and we didn't know what that exactly was, so we had to show him that that part was on the deal. And so
we talk about it a little
left
bit.
Left that part.
No, he caught up. I think it's
objections to assessment.
Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2424. This, colleagues, as you may recall, is the bill that Representative Wisnett came and talked to us about, and it involves the Adopt a Highway program to allow a group who wants to do noxious weed removal to participate as well. And we do have an amendment. So we're in work session. I'll describe the amendment before we move it. Or do we not? Just one moment.
It's a minor deletion, Mr. Chair, Committee. It's a minor deletion. Page 1 of the printed bill, deleting line 12, reference to each group.
And if I recall right, the effect of the amendment is that it allows for two groups to adopt the same section of highway. And, yeah, one could be for trash, the other for weeds. We did have some conversation, you might recall, about whether or not to try and get, well, not try and get, require the two groups to, or the one group to do both. And I decided internally that, it's a great thing to try and talk volunteers into picking up garbage, but I don't want to require the law. So that amendment is not before us.
Chair.
Yes. Representative Winger.
Just a question about you have a minimal expenditure impact form for Dash 1 amendments? But these amendments you want to move are the Dash 2, so I just want to be clear that we have everything we need. And
excellent question. Let me see what we have.
This here has the Dash 1s on it. This is the dash.
I apologize.
Okay. Are we moving the dash?
Where's the dash ones?
I mean, I don't think there is an impact to the deletion, but I don't know what the formal process is.
No, we would have to know it. Let me just check and see what the dash ones were.
I can't find
them. I don't have them in my bill file.
I apologize.
I have the dash ones.
Committee members,
if we're not moving them, I don't care.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I have a.
Representative Byer.
I do have an amendment. I'm not bringing forward that would have done what you originally said to require them to pick up litter also. So that would probably explain the dash ones.
I don't care what it says. Okay.
That doesn't explain the fiscal.
Right. Now, we are going to carry this one.
We're missing the fiscal.
Well, I think we may have to hold this one over. Thank you. Good eye.
Well, yeah, our papers, right?
Okay.
Yep.
I didn't know there were Dash 1 amendments, and I didn't catch it, but Representative Winger did.
Well, Mr. Chair, is the Dash 1 we're going to move into the bill?
No.
Well, then why do we... The Dash 2 is the amendment.
Right. We don't have a fiscal on it.
Oh, forgive me.
I'll just take it off.
It's a fiscal. I'm going to hold over House Bill 2424 and close our work session. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2999.
Let's see how far we get on this one.
And we've got a long list on this one. So, anybody 100 miles or more? No. I'm going to call Terry Witt, Barry Bashu, and Andrea Salinas first.
My very able assistant. She's a
tiny farm bill. So
he's not done. He's gonna take it.
Okay. Getting our papers handed out. Terry, you're up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We were part of the process back in 1999 of passing the original pesticide use reporting bill. And at that point in time, we knew it was going to take a year or two to promulgate the rules and set up all of the criteria. And at that time, a sunset was established of December 31st, 2009, with the expectation that we would get 7 or 8 years worth of operational experience and data to help us craft perhaps amendments to that bill. I think, as you're all aware, we've had funding problems, and really the PERS program has only collected 2 years worth of data. So we come before you to extend the sunset out, currently about another 8 years to the first of 2016, to continue to give us data and experience on collecting this data to see how useful it is and any modifications that might be necessary, and also to make the reporting location for non-urban uses more specific, particularly going from the Third Field Hydrologic Code, which is water basin, down to the Fourth Field Hydrologic Code, which is watersheds. That is roughly about a 600% increase in specificity of this location. There are, I believe, if I'm correct, there are 92 watersheds and 15 water basins, so it's about a 600% increase in specificity. We fully support House Bill 2999 and be glad to answer any questions at this point in time, either about the bill or the program from our perspective. The one thing I would add, Mr. Chairman, is that when the program was initially started, there was a very critical element that was put into statute, and that is that the funding for this program would be shared between the general fund or taxpayers and the registrants of pesticides in the state. It was a 50-50 shared match. We believe that that is absolutely essential to maintain, and we're glad to see that there has not been any attempt at this point in time to change that in statute, and would be vehemently opposed to any opportunity to change that. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Why don't we hear from Barry and Andrea, and then we'll do questions for everyone.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity. My name is Barry Beshew. I farm somewhere between Gresham and Sandy, Oregon, in Representative Van Orman's district. Appreciate the opportunity. I'm also the the elected president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, a full-time farmer. My friend Mr. Witt has once again stolen all the thunder on an issue like this, which is more than appropriate because he deals with these on a daily basis. From a policy perspective, I deal with them on a daily basis from an applicator's perspective. We, Oregon Farm Bureau, is too fully supportive of House Bill 2999. I served as a member of the Kitzhaber era's task force to develop this program. There was much give and take on all sides of this issue, and we believe that the program we have now is a great opportunity for us to be able to gather data and determine whether or not that data is usable. We would certainly hate to see a permanency in this without much more time to determine whether or not it is as useful as we think it's going to be in the long term. But we are very happy to extend the sunset date to be able to allow us to, if there's ever any money available in this state again, to be able to fund this program in the future. And I don't envy the decisions that you folks have to make. We're very happy about Representative Clem's leadership on this issue in the interim to develop a program which we think will address perhaps a major issue, which was location. We're fully supportive of changing that location to the fourth huck. We felt that's where it should have been in the first place, and it's more consistent with other data, water quality data, et cetera, that is gathered by Oregon Department of Agriculture. And we're here to thank Chair Clem, and we're also here to encourage you folks to vote for the passage of House Bill 2999.
Thanks. Andrea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the Legislative Director of the Oregon Environmental Council. OEC supports HB 2999. This bill changes the geographic reporting area for the pesticide use reporting system from water basin to watershed and level and extends the duration of the program until 2016. The information gathered by a reporting program must be usable for the program to be worthwhile. Watershed level data will result in more geographically precise information, allowing state, federal, and private dollars from conservation and water quality protection programs to be used in a smarter, more strategic manner. Watershed reporting is key to ensuring outreach and education are directed to reaching the right pesticide user groups, providing information that can help specifically tailor programs to improve pesticide use efficiency and reduce water quality impacts through programs such as the Department of Agriculture's Water Quality Program and DEQ's Pesticide Stewardship Partner Program. Going to the watershed level will also ensure that we're monitoring rivers and streams for the right pesticides in a particular geographic area. In order to implement SB 737, DEQ recently developed a draft list of the most persistent or bioaccumulative toxics in Oregon's waterways. A scientific advisory committee developed the list by assessing which chemicals pose the greatest threat to human health and or aquatic life. 70 out of the 175 chemicals on the draft list are pesticides or herbicides. If the PERS system aggregates reporting information at the watershed level, it could be a very helpful tool for identifying which watersheds are impacted by SB 737 pollutants and enable the state to address this issue more strategically and effectively. Extension of the PERS sunset until January 2016 is important for a number of reasons. Additional time is critical to evaluating whether the current methods are the most effective ways to collect the data. This includes having enough time for pesticide users to understand how to use the system and for the Department of Agriculture to ensure participation is high enough to provide accurate, representative data. Ensuring at least 5 years of PERS reporting will allow more time to show and more accurately understand trends in pesticide use. PERS data results in more efficient use of public resources to implement water quality improvement programs and monitor their effectiveness. Water quality monitoring for toxics can be very costly, and PERS data can help public agencies make strategic and cost-effective choices about which pesticides to monitor for in which watersheds based on whether the pesticides are being applied in the watershed. PERS data can also help target educational programs toward users of the pesticides that pose the greatest threat to water quality and human and animal health in each watershed. In addition, PERS will provide information about whether educational programs or regulations result in a reduction in pesticide application and toxicity. PERS data can help improve urban water quality in addition to agricultural water quality. DEQ is currently renewing stormwater permits for the state's largest cities. The new permits will require municipalities to monitor urban runoff for pesticides, and DEQ and the municipalities aren't sure yet which pesticides they should monitor for. PERS data would help municipalities know which pesticides are most commonly used within their watersheds and therefore which ones their stormwater facilities should be designed to treat and their monitoring programs should look for. Until now, there has been very little monitoring of which pesticides are applied in urban areas and detected in urban runoff. For these myriad reasons, OEC urges you to support HB 2999. Thank you for your time.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Shoffler.
Not really a question, Mr. Chair. Just, I think it was 2005 and when we funded this the first time, if I remember right, and there was a big push to, for, you know, make the areas really small, and a lot of people felt threatened. And the people that felt threatened were those that live and work out in the hinterland, whether it be in the forest, in the farm fields. And as I said then, I'll say now, no one cares about the quality of water than those who drink from the very well that's below where they're applying these products. Nobody. And I remember if I said something that, you know, cities are a cesspool. And I don't need to take a bunch of science to know that. And I look forward to seeing all the crap that's running off our yards and streets. and I'm going to be sad and scared when I see it. But I really got to compliment you guys and gals and everybody out there, because I've seen a lot of this session where people from very diverse backgrounds and beliefs and philosophies have shown us what can happen when people sit down at the table and talk things out rather than shoving things down people's throats. And I just commend you for that, and I hope we continue that kind of cooperation in this state in a wide range of issues, but I'm grateful for this right here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, no one got called a bustard yet either. That happens occasionally.
Is there a commission for those?
For the bustards?
Just checking.
I think they abolished themselves in 88.
I prefer miserable bustards, Mr. Chair. Miserable bustards.
Okay, then. Any more questions for this panel or speeches to them? Great. You're released. Thank you. So I had neglected to call Lisa Hansen from ODA up first, so I'll have her come up now. And Sonny Jones. And then I'll just hold there, and then Sue Coger, Tom Schamberger, and Emily Acklin will be the next three. But they've got slightly more sort of informational presentation if folks want to see the maps and that kind of stuff. We don't have to, actually. But
vote, but we'll check it out.
Okay, please.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Sonny Jones, who we refer to as the face of the pesticide use reporting system within the Department of Agriculture. Over the last several years of implementing this program fully, Sonny has worked with the pesticide user community in getting this program on the ground and getting what will be provided to you, the first annual report, completed. And we just recently, on January 30th, completed the second full year of collecting data. And so the 2008 report should be out sometime, I think early June, for people to look at. We've provided you in the packet with our testimony just a couple of maps to give you an idea of what the change in from water basin to watershed looks like geographically across the state. There are about 15 water basins in Oregon at the third field hydrological unit level, and there are 91 watersheds. And the 91 watersheds, as your earlier testimony indicated, match up with what we talk about in the Department of Agriculture as our Ag Water Quality Plans, Senate Bill 1010. And with that, I'm prepared to give you a brief background on the history of the pesticide use reporting system, if members are interested in that. Many of you know it has had a bumpy road from its inception in 1999 until the time it was fully funded in 2005. And clearly, one of the most contentious issues as we've worked through this implementation has been how location was to be reported and the ability to maintain the confidentiality of those individuals who are required to report into the system.
So I don't know that I want to go into the history. We got a bunch of people. I got another bill that's sort of going to have, you know, some pretty serious discussion. And if you're going to be around, we may call you back up if we get a question. But I've talked to a number of people about the bill, and I don't know that we need to get into it. Save you some time.
Can I add one more thing?
Please?
Just as a point of reference, so everybody is aware, the pesticide use reporting system is proposed to be suspended in the governor's recommended budget for the next biennium and shelved. And during the last budget rebalance a few weeks ago, the component of the pesticide use reporting system, the household use survey, which collects data from households rather than pesticide users, those using pesticides in the course of doing business, was suspended for calendar year 2009. So just to give you, it's a little more information about PERS rocky road that is it has had from its time of inception.
And nothing about this bill is contingent upon mothballing suspension, I think was the word you use. You can still reprogram. If you got the funds, you can reprogram whatever computer systems you need and implement this bill, even if it were not somehow revived in ways and means from the governor's budget?
Representative Clem, you are correct. This change is a programming change of the electronic system.
Representative Krieger.
Just, Mr. Chair, as you have heard from 2003 right on through to now, referred to as a rocky road, well, there was finally the coming together, and if you want that trust between the environmental side and land users, whether it be forestry and ag, the program needs, in my mind, to be in place and implemented. We get the dollars to do it, because I think we actually will learn something from it. And sometimes fear of the unknown, mm-hmm. I'm not so certain we should fear the unknown. Let's figure out what it is, and then if something needs to be corrected, then we can make corrections.
I have a feeling, actually, considering the options are to take the money and go use it for something else, I think both are going to be unified down at Ways and Means, saying you spend the money on this program, or if not that, you need to spend it something that we can all agree on, both users and environmental community, on something.
Also, when I looked up the bill again today, I saw I was the only Republican on the bill, and about scared myself to death before I read it again.
I kind of got you, didn't I? I can't work. Representative Beyer.
Thank you. Do you have any idea how many people that are reporting are having to report statewide?
Chair Clem, Representative Beyer, I would have to ask Sunny if she had any sense of individuals other than agencies potentially.
Well,
ODOT would be an agency that would be making applications throughout the state and would have multiple.
They're in the next panel, too, by the way. We'll be hearing
multiple applications.
Would they be the only agency that you know of?
For the record, Sunny Jones with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer. So you're asking what groups might be making applications in multiple places around the state?
Well, basically statewide that are going to have to report, and you know their reporting is going to increase based on this bill.
A lot of reporters' number of reports are going to increase based on this bill, whether they report statewide or not. I would imagine that many of the forestry applicators are going to have a big increase in reporting. Many of the large agricultural operations are going to see an increase in reporting.
But probably on a statewide, literally every single one of these new units, probably no one but ODOT is my guess.
Yeah, maybe Forest Service, because it does affect federal agencies as well.
Thank you.
And we will definitely have a discussion about what it means for ODOT here in just a few moments. Any other? Thank you.
Thank you.
So Sue Koger, I think I lied, actually. ODOT's in the next panel. Sue Koger, Tom Schamberger, and Emily Ackland. Then Ame Code, Amy Joyce, and Randy Tucker will be after that. And Sue is first.
Good morning, Chairman Clem and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. For the record, Sue Koger of Salem, Oregon, also on the faculty of Willamette University. As a physiological psychologist, I'm very concerned about the impacts of pesticides on children's health and brain development. Considerable research demonstrates the ability of pesticides to interfere with the natural chemicals in children's bodies, neurotransmitters and hormones, and thus contribute to various disorders, including learning disabilities, attention deficit disorder, as well as respiratory illnesses such as asthma, birth defects, as well as childhood cancers. Pesticide exposures are also associated with the development of Parkinson's disease in adults. On a more personal level, I have a friend who has suffered for years from sensitivity to pesticides and is now contending with the diagnosis of breast cancer. Several pesticides are a known risk factor for various cancers, including in the breast. The Pesticide Use Reporting Program was an important first step in collecting data on pesticide use. It is critical that this program be continued and expanded in order to enable continued research on the health impacts of pesticides. PERS is also an important tool or informing people who are maybe particularly sensitive to pesticides about the use of pesticides in their region. I urge you to support this common sense legislation. And I included a couple of notes in terms of the types of cancers that have been found to be associated with pesticides, as well as the neurotoxic impacts and types of birth defects. So, thank you.
Thank you. Let's see, I think Tom's next. Please.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Schamberger. I work for Marion County Public Works. And I'm also president of the Oregon Vegetation Management Association, which is a group that helps recertify spray applicators, mainly toward the roadside groups. In addressing Representative Byers' question about almost all of the counties, this will increase their reporting. Marion County, we're going from 1 to 5. And some of the larger counties, they'll increase. So that definitely will increase our costs, and that is one of our major concerns, is the cost of reporting. Not only are you going to have the time for the crews to generate these spray reports, takes 10 or 15 minutes per report. You're also going to have the increased reports for the person in the office to submit. We have concerns about the marking of the different watersheds. Somehow they're going to have to be signed or located, because when you cross from one to the other, you're going to have to generate a report. So there will be some substantial increases in cost that we have a concern about, and the loss of productivity. In the Western Oregon, when we do our applications, we're very, very dependent on the weather. So we try to get it done as quickly as we can. So any downtime is costing us. So we do have concerns. We do support the program as currently as it is. I think it's a good program. I personally come out of the agricultural community, and I believe that we need to see what is actually going on out there. But we do have concerns about the increased cost and loss of productivity. Thank you.
Let's ask a question on this. So I'm counting, and I see 4, and then 1 is a little bit in the northeast for Clackamas. Is that even county property, or is that all Forest Service?
We have county property up to Detroit. This Gates, Detroit area. We have 5. It'll go from the Willamette watershed or water basin to the 5 different sheds.
I might be wrong. I'm seeing 4 for Marion County. But regardless. So anyway, yeah. 4-fold increase or a 5-fold increase?
It does increase, yes. It does increase.
Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, you know, when I was in the union, we had to fill out our daily worksheet of what we did, and because we may be working on more than one job. And it took time, but there's a couple bills in business and labor that would establish a statewide comprehensive website where for accountability and transparency, and it's blown up into this huge issue. I think, though, with time, and I appreciate your concern, and I believe you that it will add. But if you have workers out there doing something, you have to, you already have to somewhere enter data justifying and accounting for what they're doing. So I'm hoping as time goes on, initially it may, but it may. Be a new charge, but I think as time goes on, I would imagine, wouldn't it just be woven right into the actual accounting of day-to-day work? And I hope that's what happens, rather than creating a new bureaucracy, because you have to already justify and account for every worker and what they're doing and what they're doing it with already somewhere in some database. So I hope eventually we can just, that would just overlap and be an automatic reporting system. And I'm not speaking in, professional terms.
Yeah, there's a question here. So for me, and actually, Emily, I should let you speak first if you want to add to. Yeah, I saw both counties, so I didn't know if you both wanted to comment or if you were just sharing testimony, sort of. But why don't you go ahead first, please?
Sorry.
Thank you. Chair Clem and members of the committee, my name is Emily Ackland. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I work as their environmental coordinator for the road departments. As you know, counties have been asked to do more with less, and we understand that while the watershed data that would be collected could be very beneficial, requiring counties to report the information with no mechanism or funding in place at the state level to use it, it would not be efficient use of county time or money. So our concern, in addition to what Mr. Schamberger has said, is we'd like to be assured that the county time and money is going to be put to good use so that something is done with this data that is collected. That's basically all I had to say.
I think it's an excellent point. I'll have ODA come up and respond to that and what would happen to the data if it were collected. Would it ever get used? I'll have that done in a few minutes, if that's okay.
I guess my question is, currently, you already have to report somewhere what those workers are doing and with what. Somewhere already that data exists. So I'm hoping that as time goes on, that it really won't be an extra burden or an extra cost, because you already have to report it. It already exists out there.
So yeah, I think her point is, if we did mothball this program for 2 years, mm-hmm. why would they go through the hassle of reporting it if when they send it in, there's nobody there to log it into the computer? And we can get a response to that. But I think your other point, which I'm really curious on, when your folks spray, do they, on their little report, say, I'm in Water Basin Willamette, or do they say, I sprayed between milepost X and milepost Y, or how do they log that?
We currently are in the Willamette Water Basin, so we it's all under one for Marion County.
And your sprayers are the ones that just put in Willamette Water Basin?
They do not. I do that when I enter the repairs reports. But when they're out making applications, they apply by road. That's their location, is by road. And we accumulate a list of roads generally to expedite things. But when you cross in from basin to basin, you would need to stop, accumulate the current values that you'd accumulated on that basin, create a new, you report weather data, temperature, time, location, and all that. So there's a duplication that goes on. Even though there isn't a certain accounting that does go on a daily basis, you're duplicating that several times over throughout the day, which does take time. You're going to see a crew sitting on the side of the road accumulating data when they could be out spraying.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out, too. Let me just explore this a little bit. So is the crew going to do that, or are they going to fill out the same form, and then you – I realize it's more time, but are you going to do it? So you're going to get, on this road we did this, and then you're the one who's going to have to now assign which road goes with which watershed. Or are they going to do that on their forms, where they're going to have to pick which of the four or five they were in at that moment?
That would have to be determined. I would say that more than likely I'll be able to look at, knowing the system, be able to tell which water basin that they are in.
Which shed they were in.
That they are in. But it's a good example. If you're familiar with Marion County, Meridian Road runs between Silverton and Monitor.
Mm-hmm.
It crosses over, it's fairly flat, but it crosses over into two water basins. It's going to cross into
two watersheds.
Sheds. It's going to cross from the Abiqua into Butteville.
Right.
So at some point, 6 miles of road, they're going to have to turn around in the middle, do both sides, accumulate those values, and then go to the other half of the road.
Well, they don't have to. This is really, I think, helpful for us. They don't have to turn around. They just have to say, at this milepost, we switched. Well, they don't even have to do that. You have to know which milepost they stopped at. We're not requiring they spray in certain basins. We're just requiring they record what happens.
They record quantity in basis of active material. So you would go up one side till you reach the break point, turn around and go back and do the other side, and that road is complete.
Would they have to do that, or would they just keep going and then it's half the value of whatever they had sprayed at that point?
No, that wouldn't be an accurate way. The spray report has to reflect the way it does. Well, we could possibly do that, but this it would get pretty complicated.
See, this is kind of like voter registration when we're trying to figure out where a voter is. You're walking down a street, and you got to figure out if the voter is in which, or somebody calls our office, and they say, "Hey, I'm a constituent of yours. I'm from Salem." And I'm like, "Well, what street do you live on?" Somebody has to figure out which district that street is in. So someone would have to do it. But once we know which streets are in which districts, you can program your computer database to automatically do that too. And so it's kind of, and I think that's where you're going. It's kind
that's
of a,
exactly where I'm going.
At some level, you would become an expert in, yeah, that same stretch we always spray is in Watershed 1. And so it's not every single time there's a new process for having to figure out that spray route, and is it in Watershed 1 versus 2? After about two of them, you're going to go, that's Watershed 1 again. I think that's where you're going. Representative Schaffler,
and
or did I miss it?
Eventually, and I know it is an initial cost here, I'm not denying that, but with GPS and handheld computers, I mean, and believe me, right down to the guy in the pickup in Happy Valley, they have walkie-talkies and God knows what. I don't think they have handheld, but eventually we're going to get to where we want to go. There will be initial costs. I won't deny that. I think government, definitely, we can make that happen, and we're going to have to help you pay for that, hopefully, someday, too. At least I would support that. The concern on the other side of it, on the private side, I don't think a farmer and a woodland owner, they know exactly how many drops they put on every acre right down to the thimble, in less than probably the thimble. And the fear is, and it's rightfully so, is some miserable lunatic bustard gets a hold of that information and goes burns down their machine shed. So, but I'm confident eventually we can get to where we're going with this, Mr. Chair, and get a pretty accurate reading what's going on out there.
And we're
going
to hear more about this on a broader scale from ODOT because they have even more. But we just get this stuff sort of sorted out so the committee can ask questions.
Here you go.
Representative Van Ortman.
Well, he mentioned Meridian Road, which raises an interesting question on my part, because part of it's in Marion County and another part of it's in Clackamas County. So then the question arises for me is that the coordination between the two counties, because do you just spray Marion County's portion and let Clackamas County's go to Tansy Ragwort?
Mm-hmm. No, they would spray their own and each make a report, right?
Each county's responsible for their own jurisdiction.
Well, I understand that, but one of the problems I have living in rural Hood River County is that when the orchard across the street doesn't deal with its dandelions, they're over in my yard.
Yeah, no one would not spray just because they'd had to do a second report, I don't think, would they?
Our costs are reduced from using herbicide applications versus just mowing only, so we will continue to treat. It's just there is a certain level of added cost to this that we have a concern about.
All right, thank you. I guess that wasn't an aside.
Well, that's legitimate. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This point may be moot because of the funding issue, but our friend from Marion County brought up a example that's in my district, and I wanted to go on record that I don't know how you feel, but I was a little bit shaky on what you said. I don't consider my constituents to be pests, and I'm against spraying them.
Even the little ones with wings and like eight legs and just flopping around.
Are we counting those in the census?
All right, then.
But it is moot if we don't fund this, correct?
Well, no. I'm gonna have ODA come up now and just talk about that. What would happen if we don't fund it to this data? Because that's a very good question. So, any more questions for these three? Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Lisa and the Sunny, the face of reporting. What was it? The face of something.
The face of
right.
Face
the
of
bright. Purse. The bright face of purse.
For the record, Lisa Hansen with the Department of Agriculture and Sunny Jones. And I think the question is, if the program is shelved,
yeah,
and this change is made, what happens? Assuming that House Bill 2999 were to pass and the program were shelved for the time being, the next biennium, for us that means we're boxing it up and we're putting it away for 2 years and there would be no reporting required for calendar year 10, and 11 until the program was refunded. When the program was refunded and reinstated, this change would be made, and then at that point, those individuals that are required to report into the system would report at whatever that new reporting scale were to be.
So the plan, to Emily's point, is you just don't report during this time, so we're not having you report and then no one receives it and waste your time and effort. And that's something this is really not about this bill. This is about when we're in Ways and Means talking about funding. If we don't find some funding, we just need to do what you just said in order to not waste everybody's time, basically.
Chair Clem, you're correct. It's a matter of if the program isn't funded, nobody will be reporting into it because there won't be a mechanism. The electronic system will not be up and available for people to report into. We will simply suspend it until it is refunded at whatever time.
Great. Questions? Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're extending the sunset to
2016.
So my question, I guess, is your answer accurate for as long as we shelve it and the sunset is in place? In other words, is this true for assuming we don't fund this or we shelve this each biennium up to that point, or does it change or get more complicated as the time goes on and then we get dustier on the shelf?
Well, it's probably in the way the rule's structured. Is that an agency decision or a legislative decision, do you know? So both questions, please. Sorry.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, the operation of the pesticide use reporting system will be dependent on funding being provided by the legislative body for whatever happens to it. So assuming that there were no funding provided for it in subsequent biennia, the program would continue in the suspension mode until it were fully funded again. If you remember back, the program was shelved and suspended back in 2003 due to budget constraints and was not operational until it was refunded by the 2005 Legislative Assembly with the first full year of data collection in calendar year 2007. And the law remained the same during that time frame. It was all dependent on the funding mechanism.
And we didn't have to temporarily repeal the law. You had the authority to discontinue reporting on an administrative rule basis, or just the agency director had the authority to do that without having to pass a bill.
Chair Clem, my understanding is if programs, and this is a question for legislative council, I think more so than the agency to confirm this. I think I need to frame it up. But my understanding is if the legislature does not fund a program and the law is on the books, the agency is not required to implement that program until the funding is provided.
And the program can't be removed unless the legislature removes it.
Well, it's in the statutes. The program exists in the statutes. And so what I was trying to figure out is whether you had to actually repeal the statutes temporarily. And we obviously didn't do that, so we must not have had to. We have other programs. I know we've made agencies just eat, though, and do it, whether we gave them money or not. But it was a proactive move, not a suspension of something. Like Farm to School, for example, in the Department of Education, not so happy about just having to pay for it, I would argue. But
Chair Clem, you're correct. Previously, it remained on the books. It was unfunded. And it's important to remember for pesticide use reporting that the law currently requires for every dollar of fee money, pesticide registration fees used, that it be matched with general fund to operate this program as well, and that's a statutory requirement.
Yeah. Representative Van Orman.
Well, sort of similar to the bill that we just passed last Friday, or the Thursday with the day I carried it, it was the bill on the charter fund in the Department of Education, and it eventually didn't have any money, and so they came forward to statutorily remove the fund. And so it's, to me, it's somewhat similar that if this bill is approved that we're talking about,
it means that this is going to, this PERS is going to exist until 2016. If there's no funding, it still would exist mm-hmm. until we come back and make a law that says it doesn't exist.
Or let the sunset expire.
Or let the sunset expire.
But if we don't pass this bill or something like it, the whole thing will go away after this by any.
That is correct.
And that's not anybody's goal or plan. And so mothballing is a ways and means kind of decision, I would argue. Probably that's where there's no bill on whether to mothball or not, as far as I know. It's just in their budget. And so we, I think, have an answer of what will happen under all scenarios. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's what I
yeah, let's hear more about it from either excited or concerned people about the bill. Ame Code, Amy Joyce, Randy Tucker.
Goodness.
After that, we'll have Ralph Saperstein and Michael Mason, and then we'll be done with our public hearing.
Even though the farmers are alone.
Farmers are usually three times.
Yeah.
Welcome, Ame. You're first.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, thank you so much for giving me a chance. I'm here to support House Bill 2999. I feel like my colleagues.
Would you identify yourself?
I didn't say. I'm sorry.
No problem.
My name is Ame Code. I work with the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides. And I, just to be fair, I'm not here just representing my organization. There's actually over 30 organizations, local businesses, and small farms that also support Oregon's Pesticide Use Reporting Program. I do represent them today. I feel as if my colleagues have really spoken to this program, to the benefits and why House Bill 2999 is so important. I did want to address a couple of the issues that came up in the discussion here during the hearing. Just to give you a little bit of background, this program, pesticide applicators have to report 7 items: the location, the site, the date, which is actually can be done by month, the pesticide product name, its registration number, and what am I missing? The site, which would be kind of like the crop or where it was used, if it was used in an urban area. So they have 6 to 7 items that they're reporting. It's a drop-down menu for the most part. It's a pretty quick thing. There's also the Department of Agriculture has worked very hard to make this program as easy as possible for pesticide applicators, and you might want to bring Sunny and Lisa back up to talk about the batching process. So for Marion County that might have 5 watersheds that they're working within, 4 or 5, they actually can batch all of those, not only one report for the whole month of those applications, but they can collapse all 5 watersheds into a more simple batching process, which I think Sunny could probably explain better. I just also want to put this in perspective. You know, we've got a great compromise, and under the leadership of Representative Clem, we have found a place where, you know, Oregon Environmental Council, the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, and the Farm Bureau can sit together and say, we're all supporting the same bill. I just want you all to know, as people have their concerns about this change to watershed, in California, they're reporting by square mile. They're reporting much more specifically, and these operations and these applications are still occurring. And so we need to recognize that in Oregon, we are at a compromise mode, and, you know, we do need more specific information. That's what I've heard from drinking water providers and so many other people on the ground.
Questions for Ame? Thanks. Amy.
Amy Joyce, Department of Transportation. It seems more nuts and bolts questions from the committee and the chair perhaps at this point. I've handed out some written testimony that has some maps attached as well as the reporting form that we do use. So under current law, our staff fills out daily spray report sheet indicating highway and mile point of the spray application along with specifics about product use, time, weather, temperature. And they file those reports to a central ODOT office, and our statewide vegetation control expert inputs that data into a very simple Microsoft Access database And then that is electronically submitted to Department of Ag. So that's sort of the nuts and bolts of how it works. Currently, the 13 areas, hydrologic units that are, exist under current law, I guess fortunately for ODOT, they roughly match up with our maintenance districts. So our staff who work within a maintenance district typically are reporting just within that district. So it's a fairly simple process that way to determine where they are. Under the bill, then, those areas would significantly decrease in size. We get up to something like 90, a little more than 90 areas. And the department has determined that probably the best way to comply if the bill were to pass would to retrofit with GPS units, which Representative Schaffler mentioned. We don't have those in the trucks for ODOT. If they have them at the county, we don't. And so that would be a retrofitting aspect. And then in terms of the reporting system, again, we have a very rudimentary access database that we currently use, so we'd be looking at what Chair Clem mentioned, updating a computer system. So it would be a very front-end expense for ODOT. And then after that, it would be a matter of just using those tools to report going into the future. So that's the nuts and bolts of how ODOT would implement the bill.
So let me just ask a question, because I do databases for a living. It seems to me that this form, the person on the database end, since they currently, the form doesn't say which basin you're in. It just says milepost to milepost. It doesn't
Correct.
Say which. I don't know if it says which maintenance district you're in.
Chair Clem, no, it doesn't. It's highway and mile point.
So somebody on the receiving end at centralized knows that milepost this to milepost that or crew number this is in this maintenance district, therefore they're in this basin or something like that.
Chair Clem, that's exactly right.
Seems like you would have, and it'd be more work, but you would have on the computer side, milepost this to milepost that. Automatically, the computer knows to assign that into this watershed, and then there's no GPS needed because you've got milepost this to milepost that, and as soon as they see the form, they plug that in, milepost this to milepost that equals watershed 3, and the computer will just do it. And that's how we do voter registration in Oregon. You just put in an address, you can go on most of the websites, and down to the house, you put an address and it says House District 32, and somebody had to do the database work, but no one's getting GPS devices to get that when you have milepost this to milepost that. So you have to, somebody would have to database it to have milepost this to milepost that equal a watershed, a programmer, and then after that I think you would be done. But I may be missing something wildly here.
Chair Clem, our experts who do this this reporting tell us that as you're crossing over, that the GPS information is what's going to be needed. So that's what I have. I can get some more information for you on that in terms of why that is necessary
sure.
in this situation.
Well,
sure.
I'll let me talk with the committee after this hearing and see if it's even necessary. But for me, I don't understand why milepost this to milepost that and the county maybe. Well, that's there. County this, milepost this to milepost that. That should be a if-then statement in a database, and that will auto-assign it. I would be shocked if that's not the case. But Representative Roblin.
The problem is, at what point does it change? And it won't be on a milepost. It'll be between mileposts. And so you have to know the edges. You don't have to know the inside parts really easy, but knowing all these edges is where your problem is going to be. And in many counties, they didn't have edges before. Now they'll have lots of edges. And so there's going to have to be a GPS thing that decides that place. And it's either in the vehicle so they know where it's at when they're driving, or somebody has to go out with a GPS monitor and put a mark someplace so they know where it's at. I mean, somehow the people who's applicating has to know when they cross that point.
Well, but I think it would be milepost 12.5.
Well, 12.3. I mean, you can do those kinds of things, but again, how do you know where that is? Because every car odometer is a little different. I mean, if we're really trying to be accurate where that happens, you have to know that point. So there's either got to be a marker there so they can tell when they go over it, or there's got to be something else. I mean, eventually, depending on how accurate you want to be, people are going to have to know that. Because
I really think
I agree,
computer database, if you don't have to put something physically out there, you just have to know.
You can't keep applicating because you've got to know exactly how much you've used once you go over that. All that's been used is on that side. You have to start over. How much is on being used now? So if I've got a tank, I got to know how much was in the tank when I started. When I cross over the line, I got to know where the tank is and how much is going to go after.
That's an excellent point. May I ask Ame something real quick here? The seven you listed didn't mention quantity, but is
that's
that
what I missed?
Okay.
I was
confusing me about it.
Quantity is there.
It is. I didn't mean it. It's amount used. Yes.
Okay, got it. And now I understand.
And so you also have to know the. It's the quantity of the actual ingredient, not the amount you're spraying. So you've got to know your dilutions.
Well, actually, you don't. Excuse me for interrupting. The database, there's two things about the database, and again, I defer back to ODA, but one, you put in your product and your registration number, and ODA's system tells you how much active ingredient, which is really nice.
That's nice.
That's going to save people a lot of math headaches. The other thing you should know, and I'm not sure at this point, but for location, there always was an exception. Let's say you had an agricultural field that was in one basin. It had a little dipped over into another, and this was also, they talked about it when it was square mile. If it was within 1 square mile, then there was a tiny little amount, or even, you know, a larger amount that was in another, you didn't have to report into that other one. So they weren't looking for exact absolutes.
That's not in this bill.
No, I don't think it's in this bill, and that's something we would have to check with ODA, and I don't know if
in
it's a rules
law,
or how it would work.
If it's in current law or rule, then this wouldn't delete it. We're not deleting anything, are we?
But
we could check into that.
I think it should be.
Representative Shoffley's going to kill me if I don't get a question.
Well, you know what, Mr. Chair? I think this is what frustrates the community so much, because farmers and ranchers and woodland owners have been doing this already for years and can tell you every drop they put on there. They're just afraid some crazy person's going to come burn their house down. Why is it so difficult for us to be able to measure what we're applying and when? It is not difficult. And I think we're really figuring out how many angels dance on the head of a pin here. With the advent of computers and GPS, this is going to become incredibly simple to measure and maintain data on. When a helicopter flies over a woodland area, I understand, they can tell you exactly where they dropped it, and they lap less than 2 feet as they turn around. I've learned that on my field trips. And why we have to sit here and beat this to death is beyond me. We're going to be able to do this fairly simply with the technology we have, and we just have to have the will to do it. And quantity, distance, exactly where, right down to the square inch, I think we can do this. But the whole conversation kind of drives me to distraction, Mr.
Chair. Fair enough. Let's move on. So Randy, and then we're going to lose some community members in about 15 minutes, I think. So Randy, and then I have two more after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. We are the regional government of the Portland Metropolitan Region. And I printed out written testimony and last night and left it in my office. I don't think the fate of the bill seems to hang in the balance as to whether I've brought my written testimony or not, so I decided I've emailed it to Cheyenne and I will provide it in the copies later on. Want to note that among Metro's major responsibilities is management of the region's solid waste system and also planning efforts to improve water quality and fish and wildlife habitat. The Metro Council has supported the pesticide use reporting for 10 years, and we've continued to support full funding of the program, the more specific level of reporting that's embodied in this bill, and the extension or the removal of the sunset provision. So all those are in House Bill 2999, and obviously, well, the funding is not, but two of three are in this bill, and we support the bill. For the record, as part of our responsibility for managing solid waste in the region, we operate two solid waste transfer stations. The public brings hazardous waste to those transfer stations. The most difficult waste stream for us to handle is pesticides. Many of the materials we collect can either be reused or burned for energy recovery, but there really aren't any low-cost disposal alternatives for pesticides. And our waste shed is not just the boundaries of Metro's jurisdiction, which is mostly the urban area of the three-county area in Portland, but our waste shed actually includes the full three counties. So we do have some rural areas in the waste shed that bring materials in to our transfer stations. The bill is also consistent with Metro's general approach to product stewardship, where we ask users to consider alternatives to hazardous substances before using them and to take responsibility for their proper use and disposal. We're engaged in an extensive effort of outreach with the citizens of our region about the risks posed by pesticides and how to use them wisely in the urban area. And so everything works together. We're in support of this legislation, and I'll just end it there and see if you have any questions.
Questions
for
the committee. Okay, thanks. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And Ralph Saperstein and Michael Mason.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Ralph Saperstein with Conkling, Fiskum, and McCormick here on behalf of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and I'll be very quick. We also support this bill, and I'd be glad to divert any question you have to Terry Witt, who made me come up here because I lost a bet to him.
That was easy. Any questions about the bet? Other tangibles? Okay, thanks. Michael Mason.
Chair Clam and members of the Agriculture and several other items committee. My name is Michael Mason. I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, a number of rural communities. The tribes do support House Bill 2999, but they asked me to testify briefly today about a problem that they're facing that they don't. We understand from Oregon Department of Agriculture 2999 does not address. In 2000, the tribes experienced two shocking events. Their two fishing chiefs, who were in their early 60s, passed away. These were people who had lived traditionally, had eaten salmon at every meal, almost, eaten lamprey, the roots, the berries, the traditional foods. This is a stunning event for these folks. Why did this happen? Now, they've been doing some research with the EPA about neurotoxins that were getting into fish, and you know, they have some understanding of that, but it caused them to have a deep concern about, you know, what people are ingesting. Now, the tribe's drinking water intake is in the Deschutes River near Warm Springs. I assume you've all crossed Highway 26, the bridge there. There's the Deschutes Crossing and the Rainbow Market. Well, it's just upstream of that, you know, within a half mile. When I presented to the tribal council the results of the pesticide use reporting system that had come down last year, it was just enough information to make them nervous. You have in front of you the Department of Agriculture's map with the third level HUCs. This large green sprawling blob in the middle of the map is the Deschutes Basin, which is where they're getting their water. One thing that the PERS tells us is that the primary chemical that's being used, it's an herbicide, xylene range aromatic solvent. Now, I don't know anything about this. They don't really know anything about it. It's aromatic. They appreciate that. But they can't answer the question of Warm Springs parents, you know, what are their kids drinking? So it is an improvement, and we support the amendment to bring it down to the fourth level HUCs in reporting. But again, that's this pink blob that you see on the second map that the department has provided. And somewhere pretty far south in that lower Deschutes Basin is the place they're concerned about. They're concerned about what's going in within 5 miles of their drinking water intake. They don't really care downstream, you know, for the, you know, 90% of the basin, what's going in that area. So one of the things that's odd about this is, you know, there's a government-to-government relationship between the tribes and the state agencies. Oregon Department of Agriculture participates in that. In talking with the department, they're not able under current law to provide even the Warm Springs tribal government. We're not talking about giving this to the public, putting this on the website, or any of that, but even to the Warm Springs tribal government that's concerned about drinking water and should they be testing for anything, they can't even give the information to them about what is being put in just a few miles upstream. So we're talking about this area, as I say, a little bit upstream of the bridge on the Deschutes, up to about the Pelton Re-Reg Dam that the tribes own. So I guess I'm suggesting then a friendly amendment, if that's possible to work out with ODA and the folks. And we appreciate how much people have come together on this and how much consensus there is on it so far. I would hope we could stay with that. It's a refreshing thing for the tribes to see white people agree on so much. So if we could slow things just a tad and work on that, the tribes would appreciate it. Thank you, Chairman. And
I just want to make sure I understand the request. I think that you're asking on a really pretty small level in a particular case, could they get data? And I'm thinking the answer is it would not be possible because their computers don't produce it at that level. And so they would have to, again, reprogram the database because that's what I'm reading on. So it's not a secrecy in the law issue. It's there literally is no data aggregated at that level.
Right.
And so we would have to shrink everything down to, you know, a very small basis, and that's not what I'm going to be introducing this session. Or probably in future sessions down to the 5-mile level because of the cost involved. I think the issue is, for the tribal government, it's much like many governments, including the U.S. one, which is how do we study a river or a section of a river. And the U.S. Geological Survey already does quite a bit of this. You may remember an article in the Clackamas paper about some residual, I don't remember what it was, but something that was in the Clackamas River. And that's a U.S. Geological Survey process that exists, and I think there could be consultation with them around, you know, particular rivers or sections. But this is fundamentally a question of how much can state government afford, and with other agencies already doing it, you know, how do we partner with them rather than duplicate too, I think.
Okay, Chair and members of the committee. So I wasn't totally clear about that, but the it's not an issue of the ODA being unable to provide the information under current law. It's an issue of collection or analysis of data.
The data is the data is aggregated at the basin level, so there isn't a way to just spit out in this 5-mile section because they don't collect the data that way. They collect it at the basin level. And if this bill becomes law, they'll do it at the watershed level. But again, they couldn't just pull out a 5-mile section and say, in that 5 miles, this is the data that came from that section. They just don't have it. I'm getting lots of nods.
Okay. Well, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, I guess my thing from your standpoint is the next part, and that is, do we test any of this once we know the information? And so if, you know, DEQ or whoever was testing the water above you, having that information would be helpful for you, because just because they apply it doesn't mean it ever gets in the watershed. I mean,
right.
There are many of these new applicants, when exposed to sunlight over a period of time, go away. I mean, they break down into composite parts, so they don't show up as the pesticide down the stream. So the question is, knowing what to test for is important. That's why this information is important, because now I can limit the kinds of things that I test for in my water study. But it's really the data that is collected on what's in the water that you would be more interested in, as opposed to what's being sprayed upstream. Otherwise, you have to do the same testing. They can tell you what we're spraying around here, but you're not going to know what's in your water until somebody does the test on the water.
Well, isn't the city bend upriver from you, too?
That's correct.
Yeah, I mean, Chairman. You've got a lot of questions about where things come from. Yeah.
You know, this bill, what it does for us really is to limit the number of things we have to check for real quickly. It doesn't really do anything other than that. Just because someone sprayed it up the river doesn't mean it ever got into your water system. It doesn't mean it ever got into the aquifer. But at least now you know what you should be testing for to see if it did. So I would hope that you would be checking not with ODA but with some other agencies whether they've done any testing on the water before it gets to you. That would be a better information for you about your water quality than
former ag chair knows a lot more than I do.
That's fine. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this, and certainly we'll take that suggestion. We have had some conversation with DEQ, but don't know of any testing so far. So great. We'll pursue that. Okay. Thank you very
Anything
much.
Anything else for these gentlemen?
All right. Thank you. And that's the extent of my list. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2999. Going to have some more conversations with folks before we work the bill. So now some of the members need to Van Moos. If you do, feel free. We're just going to be in a public hearing only on House Bill 2214. And this bill is the way that the law is set up on forest harvest tax every 2 years. It, I guess, sunset is the right term. And then it's been the past, the law says we review it every 2 years for consideration of renewing the sunset. So I've got Clark Seeley, Hal Salwasser, and Ray Wilkerson.
Happens.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I'm Clark Seeley, Associate State Forester with the Department of Forestry. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you this morning and testify on behalf of House Bill 2214. As Chair Clem just mentioned, the harvest tax law in the state has two elements that sunset every 2 years so that they can be, so that the tax rates can be examined given current conditions. And the two elements that do, in fact, sunset and get looked at every 2 years apply to the harvest tax used for the Oregon Department of Forestry's administration of the Oregon Forest Practices Act, and then also the revenue that supports the College of Forestry's Forest Research Laboratory at Oregon State. The bill does make the rate change, but given the fact that the rate is calculated for the Department of Forestry based upon the ending balance of the current biennium, the forecast of harvest in the next biennium, and the budget of the Forest Practices Program for the next biennium, we typically see the rates being set in conjunction with the final decision-making around the budget of the agency and the ways and means process. So glad to answer any questions about the bill with you today. My testimony includes a little bit of background about kind of where we sit today relative to harvest in the state. You all know that we've seen a dramatic decline in the harvest of wood products in the state over the last 30 years, particularly since the early 1990s with the decline of harvest on federal lands. It had stabilized essentially by the late 1990s at about a 4 billion board feet per year level. And the rates had stabilized somewhat around that number, but of course within the last year and a half or so with the economic situation and the decline in home building across the country, the harvest levels based on demand have also more recently declined. And in fact, we're projecting today, at least with the information we have, nearly a 30% decline in harvest levels for the next biennium compared to just 2 years ago. That will affect the rate again, as well as the budget decisions that are made. With that, Representative Clannam, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Let's just get through the panel first, I think. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Clement, members of the committee, I'm Hal Salwasser, Director of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory and Dean of the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2214. The Oregon Forest Research Lab delivers most of the new forest resource science and technology for the state. Our researchers work on a wide array of forest resource challenges, from tree genetics to forest soils, watersheds, water quality, forest wildlife, forest and climate, wood products innovations, wood products marketing, use of wood in green building and green economy, forest policies and other human dimensions. And the combination of the Forest Research Lab appropriation and the harvest tax is the core funding to support that full array of work. In the last biennium, the harvest tax was 92 cents per 1,000 board feet, and at current harvest levels, that yields about $2.7 million a year to support faculty and staff salaries and support services to the full diversity of our research program. the rate increased by 25 cents per thousand board feet in the last biennium to match an appropriation increase following a longstanding tradition. However, with the more than 1 billion board foot reduction in harvest, the total revenue coming to the colleges remains at pre-2007 levels despite the increase in rate. So the harvest tax last year funded about 12% of our full research budget, the appropriation about 16%, 57% was funded by grants and contracts, and it's the faculty that is whose salary is paid on the 12 and the 16% that leveraged to get those grants and contracts, largely from federal agencies. And then we have a little bit of revenue from cooperative research units. So we have approximately 2-to-1 match in the ability of the faculty to get outside money and to put it to delivering the vital information that's necessary for the forest industry and forestry agencies to be successful in their efforts. So as director of the Forest Research Lab, I support HB 2214, welcome the opportunity to work with the Legislative Assembly. As the revenue and budget processes move forward, I'm not prepared to recommend a rate at this time because, similar to the Department of Forestry, there's still a few moving parts that we won't get clarity on until the final days. Thank you.
Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Ray Wilkerson, representing the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and in the case of House Bill 2214, representing the taxpayers, along with the Small Woodlands Association. Just a bit of perspective on this. The rates that have been mentioned that were set by the last session based on the harvest projections at the time, which were much higher than the actual harvest, were designed to raise about $8 million a year just for these two programs, and there's two other forest products harvest tax programs that we pay in also. So $16 million for the biennium was projected for this these two programs. So it's not a small amount of money. It's a significant amount of money. Normally, this is a ritual, as the chairman indicated. These two programs do sunset every year, every 2 years, largely because the rates need to be adjusted anyway based on a variety of circumstances. So normally, the after the agencies testify, we come up and say that these are very important programs and that we are willing to continue to pay our fair share. And they are very important programs. There's no argument, I believe, that's anybody that's credible that Oregon State University College of Forestry is not the top forestry school in the United States. And that's an important institution for all of us and needs to be they need to have the resources to continue to have the that sort of stature. The Forest Practices Act is one of Oregon's preeminent environmental laws, and there's multiple benefits to the forest industry to keeping that law intact and well-funded. So that's normally. Unfortunately, this is not normally. This situation we find ourselves in right now, the forest industry is unprecedented, and I've been directed by our executive committee to testify today that we are not in a position to support this bill, at least at this time. And we hope that before the session is over with, that will change, then and circumstances will change, and we will be able to support it, but we cannot at this time. The industry, again, this is the worst market conditions we've ever seen. Mills are closing. Thousands of people have lost their jobs. Forest industry is just hemorrhaging red ink, and they're looking to cut costs anywhere they can. Things that normally would not be on the table, like the Forest Products Harvest Tax Bill, are on the table just out of necessity. So hopefully between now and the end of the session, this bill can be viewed in a broader context with a number of other issues that the legislature will have to deal with. And they all, from our perspective, deal with issues relating to cost sharing. You're going to have a hearing on Thursday, Mr. Chairman, on a couple of bills related to the fire program, the Department of Forestry's fire program. We support both those bills, but they're going to have to, one of them will require a renewed commitment from the state to support the fire program and the spirit of shared responsibility. And we'll talk about more about that on Thursday. The other issue that's problematic for us is that the governor's recommended budget suggests a 10% increase in our taxes to maintain the base budget for the Department of Forestry's fire program, which is separate from the emergency emergency fund. But both pieces are important. In both cases, if the governor's recommended budget was adopted, we would be asked to pay more than we currently are. And, you know, again, under the circumstances we find ourselves in, we just can't support doing that right now. And we're not suggesting that our position is necessarily going to carry the day in the session, but, you know, I'm directed to basically take that, put that on the table right now, and it's not something that we do lightly. This is, again, we've never had to do this before, but we find ourselves in a very precarious situation. So with that, unfortunately, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Krieger.
How many people do you have now in staff that are in the research laboratory area? There's federal money comes in there. There's state money comes in there. How many people do you have in that program now?
We have about 50, somewhere between 50 and 55 professorial faculty who are on joint appointments, meaning they're partly paid out of the Forest Research Lab and Harvest Tax and partly paid out of the Ed and General Fund for their teaching. Some of them also put some of their salary on grants and contracts. We have somewhere around 70 forest research, faculty research assistants, who are some of whom are partly funded on Forest Research Lab and Harvest Tax, largely funded on grants and contracts.
Sal, can you get us the information on that from the prior biennium?
Yes, I can.
Got now, and then what do you think this coming biennium? So you have the present, the one prior.
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, we actually do have that information and have been supplying it to the Legislative Fiscal Office.
Okay, I'd like to see that, see what you've changed.
Further questions for these gentlemen? We've got one more
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I just want to be sure I understand Mr. Wilkinson's position. Not in support, but does that mean of changing the tax rate or not supporting the bill in total, which would mean no tax rate?
Representative Van Orman, that's a good question. And again, I think our position is a work in progress, and it depends largely on, as I said, how other things are resolved. Hopefully by the end of the session we'll be able to support retaining the program, both these programs, at their current levels. However, doing that based on Mr. Seeley's testimony would require a 29% tax increase, because the harvest projections are 29% lower than they were 2 years ago. So just for the Dean's program at OSU, just to keep the same amount of dollars, if, you know, a steady rate would require a harvest tax rate of 92 cents a thousand to go up 29%. That's a big jump. So I can't answer your question directly,
okay.
but again, these hopefully we'll be able to provide the support that these programs need.
Well, the clarification helps. Thank you.
And unfortunately for you all, this is the kind of stuff we have to do in Ways and Means all the time on these subs. It's three or four different issues, three or four different bills. And in this case, we're doing it in the Policy Committee first. So we'll have a hearing on Thursday that will be kind of part two of cost to landowners on the fire. And then, you know, then there's their overall budget. And once it gets to Ways and Means, we don't have that bill in front of us. But this is not something you all are going to have to spend a ton of time dealing with, because I'll be trying to make it easier on you before we get there. Representative Krieger.
I'll make sure people understand that this is just one of the taxes. You got the forest tax, you got the severance tax, you got the property tax, you got the state income tax, you got the federal income tax. What else am I missing? Well, the death tax has been helped a little bit, but not as what it should have been for forestry, as you're well aware, Mr. Chair. And the costs of then going back, if you do harvest for trees, reforestation, those costs haven't really gone down any, like the timber. So a higher percentage of what you have, you know, and that's where they're talking about, I think it's 5 to 6% they like to have in an industrial forest for a profit.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see that eroded down, but there's not the incentive for people to manage forestry, and long-term we need to be doing that. And the research lab has been, forest research, ag research, those have been huge dividends come back to Oregon from those programs. So I think everybody knows we need to fund them, but it's going to be more difficult because of the costs that are being incurred now, unfortunately.
When you remember in our first meeting, I think our very first meeting, we had Marvin Brown, State Forester, come in and talk about, you know, opportunities and threats generally in the industry. And one of them is there's this spectrum of, can I make a living doing forestry, or do I exercise the existing right on every 160 acres to sell it to somebody in their house? And they don't do it at all. They just live there. And, you know, in our whole state, we lose an entire part of our culture and our economic base and everything else, and instead just have people living on houses in the woods because that's the only use of the property that's viable. So this is really pretty important stuff.
Houses don't bring in money.
Well, the home builders would say they bring in a little bit for a while. Chandler's going to come in here any second. He's not going crazy.
They end up costing them.
Yeah. All right. Any, yep.
Just one final point for perspective. You don't have any Eastside members on your committee, but this tax is a tax on volume, not value, and therefore low value timber pays at the same rate as high value timber. So it's particularly difficult for people whose timber is not worth very much, which is like Eastern Oregon, to pay this tax.
Similar kind of to the fire program for rangeland. I've heard, you know, folks from the East talk about we pay an assessment, and sometimes it's more than our property taxes. It's
right.
More than, you know, everything else. And so,
well, there's some regional variabilities that on this.
Well, I am on the other side, just
this
not
year.
That far.
Sorry.
Over.
Sorry.
Yeah, let's see. Yeah, one less. Okay, let's let these gentlemen go and get
thank
David
you.
Ford up, and then we can wrap it up, I think, just in time for floor session.
Good morning, Claire Chan.
Yeah, Claire Chan, I like it. You're not the first one who's done that, actually.
Just making sure you're all awake, and committee members. My name is David Ford. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I'm fairly new in that post, and hope to be seeing many of you in the coming months and years. I'm here to talk about 2214, and Oregon Small Woodlands Associations, similar to OFIC, is not in a position to either support or not support this bill at this point for a number of the reasons that that Ray indicated this morning. We're very concerned about the potential increase in the number of taxes that are out there for family woodland owners. We're also very concerned about the ability of the Oregon forest products industry manufacturing capacity to remain in this state, because without that manufacturing capacity, Oregon small woodland owners have a very difficult time marketing their products, and ultimately their land becomes less valuable over time. So we, like OFIC, are going to be looking at how all these bills come together related to the various issues around fire funding, as well as all the other taxes that Representative Krieger was talking about moments ago, to see how that whole package fits together. So I just wanted to state for the record where we are at, which is we want to work together with you and the Revenues Committees to assure that there's a fair balance of taxes and equity between the general fund and landowners to carry all these programs forward. So with that, I'll entertain any questions.
You've wrapped us up on a good note. You silenced
great.
Us. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2214 and adjourn the committee.